Welcome to Outbeat Radio on KRCB Windsor Santa Rosa, a program that focuses on issues by, for, and or about members of the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered communities. You can hear Outbeat Radio every Sunday night at 8 p.m.
This is Living Proof, and we're your hosts. I'm Dr. Diana Grayer, and next to me is my co-host and wife, Sheridan Gold. Tonight we have in studio Hannah Wilson. She is a psychotherapist, former radio producer, and the author of Riding Fury Home. Hello, Hannah.
Hello, I'm delighted to be here.
We're so happy to have you in studio tonight. Riding Fury Home is a book about Hannah as a young girl forced to take care of her mother after her mother's return from a mental hospital. And it wouldn't be until many years later that Hannah would learn the secret of her mother's anguish, her love affair with another married woman, and the psychiatric treatment aimed at curing her of her lesbianism. And that was taken directly off the back of the book. So we are really, really happy to have you here.
Really excited, Hannah.
Great, me too.
Yeah, and we're looking forward to learning more about you and your mom. But first, we're going to go into news and events with our engineer and Outbeat member, Greg Moralia.
Good evening, this is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio news for Sunday, October 7th, 2012. Russia's Supreme Court ruled that gay pride parades and LGBT rights demonstrations do not violate their controversial gay propaganda laws. The court made this ruling in August, but it wasn't made public until just this last week. The case involves an anti-gay law passed by the Arkhangelsk region last year, but it will apparently apply to similar laws passed by the city of St. Petersburg and others. Several cities have declined to allow gay pride parades and other pro-gay demonstrations. The laws prohibit promotion of homosexuality to minors, and the court upheld them, but said they cover only the direct promotion of homosexual relations, not pride parades or other public discussions of gay issues. Russian news agency Novosti reported, informing minors about homosexual relations is allowed as long as the information remains neutral in tone. And here in the U.S., it was 10 years ago this week that Gwen Arahu went to a house party in Newark, California, and never came home. Arahu was 17 on October 3, 2002, when she was killed. Two of the men reportedly had sex with a young woman they had known as Lita and murdered her after their suspicions that she was biologically male were confirmed. Two other young men were involved in the killing. Her last words before she was beaten was, "Please, I have a family." Afterward, Arahu's killers drove her body to a grave in the Sierra foothills. Following the investigation and two trials, Michael Magicson and Jose Merrill, both 32, are serving prison sentences of 15 years to life after being convicted of second-degree murder in the case. Jason Cazares, 32, pleaded to voluntary manslaughter. He was discharged from prison in July, according to Jonathan Parsley, a spokesman for the State Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. Jaron Neighbors, 29, pleaded guilty to manslaughter in exchange for his testimony against the other defendants and an 11-year prison sentence. Sylvia Guerrero, Arahu's mother, told the Bay Area Reporter this week that she plans to visit Merrill in Soledad State Prison, perhaps before the end of the year. She said, "I've talked on and off with the Merrill family for years. Jose Merrill is in Soledad and I plan on visiting him." She said that of the four men, Merrill has always been remorseful. "It's kind of scary, but I think it's time," she said. "I think he owes it to Gwen, and he owes it to me." Guerrero suspects that a lot more happened to her daughter than was testified in the courtroom. She added, "I need to know the truth. I don't think I'll be ever at peace, but the truth will set us free." And in San Francisco, several dozen gay rights protesters demonstrated Thursday outside St. Mary's Cathedral in San Francisco as Salvador Corleone was installed as the city's Roman Catholic Archbishop. Corleone is noted as a conservative who was very active in the campaign to pass California's Proposition 8. The former Bishop of Oakland has been quoted as saying, quote, "The ultimate attack of the evil one is the attack on marriage," end quote. In addition to facing opposition from gay activists, Corleone was also recently arrested for drunk driving and faces charges in San Diego. Last Monday, he entered a guilty plea to reckless driving, a lesser charge. Outside the cathedral, protesters included Brandon Clausen, a 20-year-old who relocated to San Francisco from rural Pennsylvania. Clausen, who was brought up Catholic, told the Chronicle, "You come to a bigger city and you have guys like this, like he's top-notch, like he can change everybody. You can't change people. I feel like I'm part of a cult when I tell people I'm Catholic." And here's your calendar of events for the coming week. On Monday, October 8th at 7 p.m., the Spanish-speaking parent support group will meet at the Positive Images Center, 312 Chin Street in Santa Rosa. And on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, October 9th through the 11th, from 12 noon to 4 p.m., face-to-face Sonoma County AIDS Network offers free and confidential anonymous HIV testing at their offices, 873 2nd Street in Santa Rosa. No appointment is necessary. And on Tuesday, October 9th at 6:30 p.m., the Transgender North Bay Group will gather at the Positive Images Center. On Wednesday, October 10th at 5 p.m., the Youth Support Group will meet at the Spectrum LGBT Center, 30 North San Pedro Road, Suite 160 in San Rafael. And also on Wednesday at 6 p.m., the Redwood Rainbows Sonoma County LGBT Square Dance Club will hold its beginner's class at Wiseman Hall in Sebastopol. And on Thursday, October 11th at 12 noon, the Men's Brown Bag Lunch will take place at the Spectrum LGBT Center in San Rafael. And on Saturday, October 13th at 7 p.m., the Russian River Sisters will present Shiver Me Timber Bingo at Old Fellows Hall in Guerneville. This event benefits the Chrysalis Community Counseling Services. Everyone is invited to dress up for a costume contest. You can learn more and get your tickets at the Russian River Sisters website at rrsisters.org or at the door, which opens at 5:30 p.m. This is an event for 18-year-olds and older. For Gary Carnevale, I'm Greg Moralia. Now back to Living Proof with Sheridan Gold and Dr. Diana Greyer.
And if you just joined us, this is Living Proof, as Greg just said, with Diana and me, Sheridan. And we're in studio this evening with Hannah Wilson, author of Writing Fury Home. And before we, I'll let you say hi, Hannah.
So hi, it's wonderful to be here.
Before we get to the interview, I just wanted to explain how we came to have Hannah join us. I go to Born to Drum Camp every summer, and Hannah was there, but I didn't know you. Mm-hmm. And every year they have people from, not the teachers, they have the participants of the camp share if they want. It's not a talent show. It's more like a showcase. And Hannah read from her book. Mm-hmm. And I was like so affected about the story that you're about to hear, because Hannah's going to tell us. That I started crying, and I was so moved, and I was videotaping the showcase, and so you can hear me going like this on the videotape when she was sharing. So anyway, we talked the next day, and I invited her to come on our show, and here she is. And we wanted Hannah here in October because it's coming out month and coming out day on the 11th, and so we were here wanting you to join us for October show. So
wonderful, yeah, and. Actually, my story is about a double coming out. I come out and my mother come out in the 70s. So maybe I'll just say a little more about the story that you started to introduce. Well, it really goes from stigma and shame and secrets to a sense of belonging. And it starts in the 1950s when I'm growing up with a mother who's severely suicidal. And she attempts suicide when I'm 7 and is in and out of mental hospitals. And I really won't know the secret of her anguish until I'm 20. But she survives. I leave home, and I get immersed in 1970 in the women's movement and come out as a lesbian. And a couple months later, my mother comes out as a lesbian and comes to this astonishing joy. My depressed mother becomes a happy, joyful woman. And she tells me what happened in my childhood, which is that she and another married woman were lovers when I was a baby for 2 years, both given psychiatric treatment to cure them, because in the 50s, homosexuality was considered a disease, which led to their breakup, her heartbreak, and her despair. So it's really, it's a family story, an intimate story of a mother and daughter, and my father's in it too. But it's also the story of two women immersed by changes in the culture and how those changes in the culture, sort of cultural history, transformed both of our lives. So
I'm curious about what directed you to writing this story. I mean, what made you decide to write your memoir about this? Was it because of all of this, what you just shared?
You know, I have to go back. I'll try to give you not the longest version. Mm-hmm. But I actually, long before I started writing the book, had a terrible writing block. I could not write. And I had this dilemma because I had dropped out of college, and when I decided to become a psychotherapist, I had to go back, finish a BA, and go to graduate school. But how was I going to write academic papers? So I asked myself, what are you so afraid of about writing? And just kind of what came out of my mouth, leapt out of my mouth, was that the truth might come out. And what I meant by that truth was all the secrets from my childhood. So I was really lucky. I deliberately took a class taught by a feminist creative writing teacher, and I told her, I want to write some of these stories I'm terrified will come out so that I can, you know, break free of this. And so we would do these writing exercises in class. You'd give us these 15-minute writing exercises, and the sweat would just be dripping off my body. And I'll never forget the first time that and then we would read out loud what we'd written. So I remember the first time I'd actually written about one of my mother's suicide attempts. I read this story. There was this potent silence. And when I could really see on my classmates' face how moved they were, and then they started sharing hard stories of their own. And the shame started to ebb away because I saw how our deepest stories connect us as human beings. And so I put my writing away and did academic writing, my creative writing, for years. Then when my mother was ill with cancer and dying, well, she didn't admit she was dying. She said, I'm going to beat this thing and live to write a book about my life. So that actually motivated me to start writing. And I thought I was going to be writing her story. But as I started writing, I discovered, no, I have to write my own narrative with my mother in it. Mm. So would you like me to read a little from the beginning of the book?
Oh, that would be terrific.
Okay. This is the very beginning of the book, and I'll read you an excerpt. This chapter is called White Plains. I was the first child ever allowed to visit a patient at the private mental hospital where my mother was being treated. Before our first trip there, Dad said, "The doctors think your mother will get better if she can keep seeing you." Visiting hours were on Sunday, so I had to drop out of Jewish Sunday school, which I had just begun 6 months earlier. Though I was 7, they had put me with the 6-year-olds because I didn't read any Hebrew. The odd-shaped letters blurred before my eyes, and I made no attempt to decipher them. But I loved singing, humming along to the guttural language. On the easy songs like Hava Nagila, I belted the words. After songs, we got to eat exotic treats, dates, figs, and rugula, buttery spirals of dough with raisins and cinnamon. My father and I sang on the 2-hour drive to the hospital, up the New Jersey Turnpike, over the Tappan Zee Bridge. He taught me his favorite. I'll build a bungalow big enough for two. Big enough for two, my honey, big enough for two. And when we're married, happy we'll be. Under the bamboo tree. Dad and I sang and sang, ballads, show tunes, and spirituals, as our old brown Hudson lumbered along, going to see my mother, who was not a mother. My need of her was frozen, clamped down against any thaw. But she needed me. Maybe if I loved her enough, my mother would heal. I remember the grounds, the front lawn in expanse of green with a curving drive. The visitors gathered outside the front entrance, waiting for the appointed hour. The gates were locked until then, and there was a quiet hush among us, the waiting families. Dad held my hand. In my imagination, the buildings are dark and gothic, hovering like some dragon ready to pounce. That first time, and every Sunday afterward, I met my mother at the foot of the stairwell. As she came down the stairs, I looked up at her face, puffy and sallow. She leaned over to hug me, and I reached up my arms, willing myself not to pull away. But I flinched a little. She took my hand, and we ambled onto the back lawn, my father trailing behind. Mom moved slowly, and she stumbled now and then. We walked past the tennis courts. "Fancy schmancy, huh?" Mom said. Then she laughed, but she didn't sound happy. I knew Mom tried to play. She told me that all the patients were on so many drugs that they missed a lot of balls. I always brought Happy, my favorite stuffed animal, with me. One day, Mom and I were sitting on some steps outdoors when another patient came over. He leaned over and put his face close to mine. I could smell his foul breath. He pointed at Happy. "What a nice bunny!" Happy's long, floppy ears must have misled him. "He's not a bunny, he's a dog," I protested, in an outburst of anger that was taboo to express around my mother. She was sick, it was not her fault, and I knew I must not get angry at her. Mom put her hand on my back. "It's okay, honey," she said. The man scowled at me, turned abruptly, and stormed away. One time, my father had a meeting with my mother's psychiatrist while I waited in the car. I watched him walk back, hands in his pocket, head down. He got in, sat behind the steering wheel, put his face in his hands, and wept. Then finally he said, "The doctor says your mother will never get well. He says she is incurable." I looked down at my hands. Happy had dropped to the floor. Somewhere inside, I knew I must not be doing a good enough job. On winter days, the hospital gave my mother a pass, and we went into town. We always went to the movies. I remember seeing Peter Sellers in The Mouse That Roared, a zany film about a tiny country that invades America. In that dark cinema, I could enter another world and forget the bloated stranger called Mother who sat beside me. After the movies, we always went to a local steakhouse, and the three of us ordered the same thing, T-bone steak with French fries. How I lived for the dessert, parfait in a tall glass, layers of vanilla ice cream and frozen strawberries in syrup, gleaming red and white. I would spy the parfait on other diners' tables, anticipating its soft, tart sweetness in my mouth. So that ends the first chapter.
So what really stuck out for me is twice you talked about how you felt like you weren't doing a good enough job in loving your mom. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about how old you were when this happened, when you went to the hospital the first time, and did you ever lose that it's my fault as a child perspective?
It's kind of hard to remember. Did I ever lose it? I don't think I ever fully lost it. No, I was 7 years old when my mother went in the mental hospital, and she was in for almost 2 years. So I was around 9 when she came out. And when I was 10, my father, who was a scientist, had a research grant in London, and he left me with my mother for a year. And that was the year I really ended up having to take care of her, to put her to bed at night, because she was on a lot of psychiatric drugs, and she would get very dopey when she took her sleeping pills. And she attempted suicide twice that year. So, you know, there's, I think part of the Writing Fury Home, one of the threads of the memoir is, and this happens to a lot of children who have to caretake their parents, or the parents are absent or emotionally absent, is the sense of that I had to suppress my anger and my need of my mother. So it kind of left, it engendered a suppressed rage in me because she was too fragile and it was too scary to get angry at her. So part of Writing Fury Home is really the journey of working through that hurt and anger and need as my mother healed also in life, for the two of us to come to some forgiveness.
Mm-hmm. How did you come up with the title, Writing Fury Home?
Well, it actually was the title of a chapter. All the chapters have titles. And so one of the chapters was called Writing Fury Home. And I was one of these horse crazy girls. And so that chapter's about, there was a show on TV called Fury. And it was about a black, wild black stallion that this orphan boy, Joey, can ride. It was like amazing. And for my 11th birthday, my mother takes me to a rodeo where the horse is going to make an appearance, Fury, from this. And I don't want to give it away, but something happens on the way there and the way back that echoes that Riding Fury Home theme. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
So you had a chapter called Riding Fury Home, and then you decided, hey, I'm going to just call the book Riding Fury Home.
You know, I can't remember exactly, but you know, a lot of times when you're writing, you don't understand what you've written until you're done. Mm-hmm. And so I think as I was thinking about a title, I was thinking about what were the threads, what was the arc of the story, and Riding Fury Home really seemed to capture it. So, yeah.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Makes me want to go back and read the chapter about the horse.
Yeah.
Although I think I remember what you're talking about.
There also, my mother used to read me Greek myths before she went away. And the Furies, who are Greek deities, make a little cameo, which I won't tell you what happens. But these are wild women who are vengeance seekers. And they have snakes in their hair and wings and claws. And they attack people who do bad things, especially family injury of family members, and especially matricide, the killing of mothers. So they make a cameo in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Hannah, you talked about the rage, and that word is a powerful word, rage. And you say you worked through it through your book. I'm just curious about how did you, could you explain that, because the audience hasn't read the book. How did you show up your rage? How did it show up with your mom in relationship with her after, you know, 2 years you tended to her? And then,
you know, I think as a child, my anger, rage may be excessive. I think it was a suppressed, you know, rage. But I probably was quite nasty to my mother in certain ways as a child, but not direct. I could never speak about, I probably didn't even really comprehend what was really boiling in me, the grief of not being able to rely on a mother, or my father, actually, who was gone. So the working it through was doing therapy myself as an adult, finding community, coming out as a lesbian, interviewing my mother on radio and having her tell me about her life. And also, my mother did a lot of therapy and also became a therapist. My mother did. So she was able to, at some point in adulthood, say to me, tell me what it was like for you as a child. I want to know. And it was really hard for me to do, but she stuck with it. And she said, I'm strong enough. Tell me about it. I know it was really horrible for you, and I'm so sorry. And so we were able to really kind of work on that and work that through. Mm-hmm. To some extent,
And I love hearing that and reading that about that invitation. And so many, like you say, so many more kids need that invitation to just speak about the pain.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I also love what your mom said about the sick part of her. She say, you're something in the book that was going on. Help me out here, sure. She was talking about you're in conversation with your mom. And she said something like, but I was sick, you know, but I was sick.
Well, you know, the two of us were able, when I found out what had happened in my mother's childhood, to have kind of a shared analysis, political analysis, that she had been the victim of external cultural homophobia and internalizing homophobia. And so, you know, that comforted us both, because it wasn't just all her personal fault. Now, of course, we had a lot of personal issues to work through nonetheless. So, yeah. I wonder if we want to hear a little. And I was a radio producer in the 70s and did kind of pioneering lesbian radio. And I interviewed my mother in 1974, and I have a few excerpts that I could play. And the first one is actually about her telling me how she came to love another woman when I was a baby. Can you hear that?
So when did you start having a relationship with a woman?
My friend Marion. Oh. You know, I can't quite remember that. I know you were a baby.
Uh-huh.
And she was my best friend. And I really loved her as a person. She was married to a man much older than herself. And we went around together. We spent a lot of time together. Just as friends, talking and going fishing and sharing our ideas and our thoughts. And then one day she said to me, Gloria, and she told me how beautiful love could be between women. And she meant love on every level, including emotional, sexual, intellectual, every level. And it really, she didn't have to convince me, because, I mean, it almost felt right away almost natural. Because I really loved her as a person.
Boy, hearing your mom's voice, how is that for you? I mean, does it bring back memories of your interview back then? Or her voice is so beautiful and deep and strong.
You know, after my mother came out, she wrote me a letter, and she said, I just want you to know that when I get up in the morning and I look in the mirror, I feel so happy to be alive. And I discovered that my mother was actually a very upbeat, joyful person. So when I did this radio interview with her, we got to talk about all these secrets and all of her history that had been kept so in the dark and silent. And it was very, very important for me personally, but I think also for other women, for other women coming out then, for young women in the 70s and now, to hear the history of those who came before us and what they'd been through. My father had told me how, you know, when my mother was in a mental hospital, they brought in a specialist whose specialty was to convert gay people into being heterosexual. He met with my father, and he told my father, hang in there. I've helped other gay people become happily heterosexual. So my father decided I will stay with her. I would stay with her if she had tuberculosis. So I'll stay with her while she's being cured of this disease, which, of course, just led to everyone's misery.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, this is just, you know, I hate to use the word awful, but it's just sad. I mean, this is living proof that you can't not strike out somebody's sexual orientation. I mean, your mom had to suffer and go through this pain so early in her life, and then she's lesbian and she gets to experience it. Thank you for sharing that piece.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah. You know, we have this amazing thing that happened in California. I don't know if you know about it, that the governor just signed this bill, SB 1172, mm-hmm. which makes it illegal for a licensed therapist mm-hmm. to give minors the same therapy that my mother was getting, mm-hmm. which, you know, the Diagnostic and Statistic Manual said gay people are not a diseased, you know, in 1973. So this is still happening. So, you know, my mother actually at that time had these electroshocks, and I wondered if we'd like to hear about that. It was a very grueling experience.
So when I got there, they told me that I was to have 18 shock treatments. And I don't remember signing anything. I think your father signed me in. But I know I was depressed, and I was unhappy, and I felt I was pretty sick. And I didn't know how to get happy, or even to get not feeling miserable all the time, and wanting to, or in pain all the time, in agony all the time, in torture all the time. So they sent me to this place, and they gave me an electric shock. And I was terrible. I felt terrible. And every time... I remember after the first shock, I called up my parents, get me out of here. I used all my chance, called up my friends to get me out of here. And it wasn't until 18 shocks later that they let me out of this place. And then I remembered you, I remembered your father.
You know what happened when you were there? I remember I was in second grade, I think. And one time we were going to go to see you. And Dad said to me, when we go to see you, she may not remember who you are. And I remember I was in second grade, what that did to me, how that felt, that my own mother might not know who I was. Really.
Well, luckily I didn't know who you were. But I know that when I got home, I didn't remember where we lived. I had to learn the whole town again that I knew by heart. People would come up to me and say, hello, Gloria, and I wouldn't know who the hell they were. And they could have been old friends, and some of them probably were. But I just didn't remember. And it took me a long, long, long time before I got my memory back. And I don't know whether I've ever recovered all of my memory. But I know that it didn't help my depression any. It only made me worse. And they had to send me away.
Wow. I've never heard a first-hand account of how it felt to go through that.
Yeah, unfortunately, my mother, before she left, spoke German, French, some Yiddish, and read Latin. And when she came back, she couldn't remember the languages. And she never really recovered all that. So,
Was she aware that she knew them at some point? Or was it just not even in her purview?
I think she remembered that she knew them. Mm-hmm. But, yeah.
That must have been horrible.
Yeah. So,
I just want to say something. I mean, I'm just really affected by, you know, the your mom and what she shared. And I'm just curious, how do you tell the story and you ask the questions? I mean, how are you affected hearing it over and over again? What happens in you?
You know, not much right now because, you know, but I think to really, in the memoir, to tell the story, it was very hard and I had to do many, many rewrites to really go into the feelings, because I was a child where no one was helping me with my feelings and no one was asking me what I felt. So I really felt it was important for the memoir to really evoke those feelings. But it took a lot of kind of trying, you know, sort of thinking about sounds, smells, memories, just to evoke it all. And, you know, luckily, like I said, I was lucky. My mother survived. And because of the women's liberation movement, the gay liberation movement, we came into a sense of belonging, a community, and a lot of healing. So I think that it had a happy ending, made it bearable to go back. And, you know, there were actually a lot of the story my mother didn't remember because of the electroshocks, and my father spent a lot of time, they were divorced, and my mother was not alive anymore, but when I started writing the memoir, my father was willing to excavate the past. And this was very monumental, actually. He'd had what I call a transcendental stroke. And when he came back from that, he was like open-hearted. And so he told me things that my mother didn't remember because of the electroshocks. For instance, this is kind of horrific, but the first attempt of suicide my mother did was with my father's rifle. And the gun jammed. She pulled the trigger, but the gun jammed. And she didn't remember this. And the story my mother had constructed was that her psychiatrist and my father had decided she was suicidal and against her will locked her up. So when my father told me this, it gave me a whole new context that no one was really a villain in this story, that everyone was suffering and struggling. And it made it a more complex story, for me it made it more complex and rich and human. Mm-hmm. And that really helped to know, you know, kind of that.
How? I'm sure your dad's read the book.
My father's not alive, but I did share as I was writing it. He was very supportive. I hadn't quite finished when he died. Mm. But it was hard. It was tough. He read some of the hardest chapters that were about when he left me with my mother and went to England and she attempted suicide twice. And, you know, when I was a child and I was 10, I wrote him these phony letters and I never told him about it. So for him to read it was also healing for us. And he would say, "I'm so sorry, but we can't change the past." And I said, "You know what, Dad? By being able to talk about it, we are changing the past."
Mm-hmm. And then he was open.
It was hard, but it shifted things for us. It healed a lot. And actually, before my father died, he was able, my partner and I got married in 2008 before Prop 8 passed. And my father was able to be completely joyful about us getting married. So he, like the culture, had really evolved and opened his heart and come to a whole other understanding about LGBT issues. Yeah.
So then if I can just reiterate what I think I understand you saying, that your mom fell in love with a woman when you were a baby and loved this woman, but she didn't go into the hospital at that time. She went in after she attempted suicide when you were 7.
Yeah. The little bit longer version of it is that she was so in love with her, she wanted to take me and go live a life with this woman, but it was the 50s. They couldn't see a way to do it. The other woman, after 2 years, had a nervous breakdown, went in a mental hospital, came back, said, "We have to stop." My mother started seeing a psychiatrist who was trying to get her to adjust to her marriage. but it made her feel worse and worse because she wasn't able to be her true self, and she had despair that she'd ever be able to love another woman. Mm. Maybe we could play the third cut, which is what my mother says about coming out and how she feels about that today.
Excellent.
Okay, I think that really I've been a lesbian all my life, and I just didn't want to acknowledge that fact. That I think young people today who are coming out are really lucky that they're able to be themselves and to love women. You know, I was pretty lucky that I finally got into the women's liberation movement. I mean, the women's liberation movement did more for me than all the damn therapists and psychiatrists and hospitals and medication. It took me years to be able to be open to my joy, to my anger, to my fear, to be able to express everything now. My distaste, my dislike, my pleasure, everything. And it's really wonderful now. And I really feel pretty good about myself now. But
you do.
I really do. Yeah. I feel like a special person.
You are.
And being your mother makes me feel extra special. I'm not just saying that. I really mean it, baby.
Boy, those are some healing words right there that you'll have the rest of your life.
Beautiful. Yeah.
I mean, what a great opportunity to have this interview, to have the studio at your fingertips, and then it kind of gave you the format to ask the hard questions.
I know. I interviewed her for 2 hours. We edited it down to an hour. It was amazing. Yeah. And my mother adored me. There's no doubt about it. So, yeah.
So you brought some music. And I think it'd be great if we just had a little music break.
Okay, well, let me introduce this music because it's a flash from the past. And it's Roberta Flack. And what happened was when my first girlfriend dumped me brutally, my mother had moved from New Jersey into Greenwich Village, and she had a girlfriend, a lover. And I showed up in their at my mother's little studio, New York apartment. At a kind of awkward moment, but luckily it wasn't that awkward. But it was a very romantic moment. There were candles everywhere. My mother's girlfriend was in a kimono, and my mother was dressed. And they're about to have a meal. And it was the most romantic atmosphere ever. And my mother had this Roberta Flack album on. And I came into this song, and I was just bedazzled seeing my mother loving another woman.
And the endless skies, my love, to the dark, and the endless skies, and the first the earth of a captive bird that was there. At my command, my love, that was there. At my first time ever I lay with you, I felt your heart.
And welcome back to Living Proof. We're in studio with Hannah Wilson, and this is Living Proof with Diana Sheridan, and that was like one of the most beautiful songs in the whole wide world. Mm-hmm. Roberta Flack, The First Time I Ever Saw Your Face. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for sharing that with us and setting the scene of your mom and her partner, her mm-hmm. lover, mm-hmm. having dinner together. And
mm-hmm. wow. So, yeah, thank you. Yeah, also. So, you know, in your book, there are some letters, some coming out snippets or something about your mom. We would love to hear something.
Oh, sure. I'd be happy to read you that. So let me just set this up a little bit. Okay. So this is 1970. I have moved to San Francisco. I'm 19 years old. My mother's back in New Jersey. And I don't know anything about her history. I don't know anything about that she had been with a woman when I was a child. I just knew she was depressed. That's all I knew. Right. And so I have just become lovers with another woman. I've just come out as a lesbian. I'm living in a house with like 17 roommates, and Gay Women's Liberation meets there. And my mother. So one day I take a walk and we go to a phone booth, my girlfriend and I, and I call my mother. And phone booth was like these old big glass things. Some people might not know about it, but you actually put money in it and call. Anyway, and she had a terrible, I came out to her on the phone in New Jersey, and she had a really terrible reaction. And I had no understanding of her own history and why she would be so scared for me. She was really scared for me. She had a therapist who she was telling, I think maybe my daughter's a lesbian, who was saying, you better get her back to men or she might become suicidal. Well, this was my mother's history, so my mother was just terrified. But it didn't take too long till things started changing. So I'm going to read a few letters that my mother sent me. So here we go. Over the next few weeks, Mom and I wrote each other letters, avoiding the phone. She was not much of a writer, and her letters were short and to the point. In her first two notes, she repeated her concern that with women I was heading for a life of depression and loneliness. I felt bad for her that she was torturing herself over me, that none of my arguments seemed to be changing her mind. And I gave her a lot of political feminist rhetoric arguments, let me tell you. It didn't work. Then came her third letter. I read it out loud to Kate, my girlfriend. My God, listen to this. Dear Hannah, I have quit therapy. Women's liberation is going to be my therapy from now on. I have joined an older women's liberation consciousness-raising group. It's wonderful. We talk about everything. Love, Mom. I wrote back a jubilant letter of joy and encouragement. A few weeks later, another letter. Dear Hannah, I read about the gay women's organization, Daughters of Bilitis, in that terrific book you sent me, Sisterhood is Powerful, and I went to one of their meetings in New York City. I now fully approve of everything you are doing. In fact, I feel very close to you. Love, Mamushka. At first I thought, what an incredible supportive mother I have, going out to meet lesbians in order to understand me. Then I wondered, what was she really saying? Something held me back, though, and I didn't ask. It seemed delicate, as if she were wavering on the verge. I didn't want her to react by me pressing her. Couple weeks later, dearest Hannah, I have told my older women's liberation group that I am bisexual. Several of the women had negative reactions. I know over time they will come to better understanding. Myself, I wake up in the morning, look in the mirror, and feel so happy to be alive. Love, Gloria. That was it. I had a caller. This was incredible because as far as I knew, she'd been celibate for years, at least since she and my dad had separated when I was 12. As soon as she picked up, I launched in. I got your letter about women, about the telling the women and older women's liberation that you're bisexual. So what the heck is going on? I mean, do you mean you're having relationships with women? Yes, sweetheart. Her voice had a lilt in it I couldn't remember ever hearing. I leaned back against the glass wall of the phone booth, digesting that. Wow, Glor, that's fabulous. She laughed. I pushed on. So are you having relationships with men? No. Are you planning on having relationships with men? No. Well, Mom, I hate to tell you, you're not bisexual, you're a lesbian. You're just scared of the word, but it's not so scary. She was pretty damn nonchalant. Guess so, honey.
That's great. Oh, wow.
Wow, so she just, oh my, what a journey.
Yeah. So my mother moved from, you know, the suburbs of New Jersey into a vibrant lesbian community. I, in the meantime, was living in a vibrant lesbian feminist community in San Francisco, and we'd visit back and forth, and we'd go to lesbian bars together or to the women's coffee house. You know, there was a whole culture in the 70s, a women feminist culture that we took part of together. So she'd come to my lesbian collective in Berkeley and eat vegetarian meals, and we'd, you know, do our rants about whatever.
Oh, that's yeah. So beautiful.
Yeah.
So your mom came out to you, you came up to your mom. Were you out before night? I mean, when did you know that you were a lesbian, Hannah? When?
It wasn't that long before my mother came out, really. I mean, I moved into this house. I already was a feminist, and I moved into this house that happened to have Gay Women's Liberation meeting there. And I was terrified because as far as I knew, I'd never met any lesbians. But when I went to the first meeting, it was like 60 women in this room. They were laughing. They looked like me. There was a nun, an ex-nun, standing up telling her story of leaving the convent. I mean, it was fabulous. And I just felt like I'd come home. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And my friend who'd left college with me and I, we became lovers. And we were very, you know, dear friends. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Wow. Well, I'm thinking about what your mom said, Hannah, about therapists. She said, I got rid of my therapist. It doesn't say much about you and me because we're both therapists, right?
Yes, well.
So, well, you know what I mean. I'm not saying that, but you know, that was joking. But yeah, so let's just segue into that, you being a psychotherapist and the work that you're doing with people. And how did you get to become that? It has anything to do with the way your story that you're sharing? Or?
Well, I think that having done a lot of therapy myself and how meaningful and healing it was part of it. I also was in radio for 10 years, and I interviewed a lot of people in radio, and I wanted to go deeper. You know, I had an international women's music show, and I interviewed women from all over the world, and I loved hearing stories. But, you know, you can, as we know, you can only go so deep on radio. And so I decided that I wanted to become a therapist. And, you know, I think writing the book for me is, there's the idea of the wounded healer. I think doing my own healing and also finding a way to really re-inhabit my own childhood where I could feel the feelings that I couldn't express then means that I can go deeper with my own clients because I could go deeply with myself. Mm-hmm. And also feel very much that people's creativity and kind of their deeper selves can come out through a therapeutic relationship. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if you can give us a little, just a contrast, I'm thinking about your childhood, like you're just speaking about, to give other people that same opportunity to express themselves. So you had your first 7 years with your mom, and it was pretty wonderful. First 7 years, and then she...
I mean, it was, you know, I don't know. My mother probably was depressed somewhere in those 7 years because she'd already broken up with her partner, but she read me stories, she read me Greek myths, she played music for me. My mother did some lovely mothering things in those first 7 years, so yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so then the 7 to 9 to high school, you were taking care of your mom.
Yeah, she was gone. I lived alone with my dad. And when she came back, I was taking care of her, and my dad came back, and then they divorced. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
yeah.
You know, I think one of the things that helped my mom and I after my parents divorced, it was the mid-60s. Mm-hmm. My mother and I both got involved in the anti-Vietnam movement. Mm-hmm. And there's something about finding comrades, you know, finding community, whatever it is, where you don't feel like it's all about your personal mm-hmm. problems, but there's something that you're joining with other people to try to make a change. And that was mm-hmm. very enlivening. Mm-hmm. And so I think that was the beginning of some of the healing. Mm-hmm. Finding community is really important.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I was picking up on. I mm-hmm. wanted to hear more about
yeah,
that.
And
connecting
then,
of
then
you and
then coming
your mom.
Out yeah. in the midst of a gay liberation movement and a women's liberation movement, mm-hmm. you know, where there was coffee houses you could go to. There was all kinds of political action, consciousness-raising groups. Mm-hmm. It was a feeling of belonging that I hadn't had when I was isolated, when I didn't want to bring children, other friends over mm-hmm. as a child because it was so shameful to have a mentally ill mother.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Wow. So I would think that listening to you, I would think that writing this book and exploring your own story mm-hmm. has helped you be a better therapist, I would say, yes? Would you
yeah,
agree?
I think so. Yeah. Because, you know, it was interesting. I didn't think it was going to be that healing to write this because I figured, I've done all this therapy. I have all this insight. You know, sorry, that sounds very...
yeah, I'm
no,
saying,
but that's
where
what
did
you
get that? I'm no, thinking,
I mean,
like,
but that's
from,
what you
from,
thought,
from
though.
Being in therapy, mm-hmm. not, you yeah. know. But there's something about really, really inhabiting your own story and expressing it, whether you say it out loud or whether you write it or whether you draw it or whether you sing it or whatever you do, mm-hmm. that, you know, furthered my being able to do that with other people. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Well, can you talk a little bit about your website and where people could find this book?
Sure. It's available in print and as an ebook, you know, in all forms, Nook, all the different forms of ebooks and in print. And I suggest going to your local independent bookstore and supporting them. But you can look on the website is writingfuryhome.com.
Can you spell that, please? Because writing, you know, could
okay,
be heard
R,
as...
It's like a horse, riding a horse, R-I-D-I-N-G, fury, F-U-R-Y, home, like going home. HOME.com, and there's links to how to buy the book, but it's really in local bookstores also, and the Facebook page is Writing Fury Home also. You could even just Google Writing Fury Home, and the website and the Facebook page will come up, and yeah.
And I just want to note that we've been on your website, and there are more snippets of your mom mm-hmm. talking.
That's right. There's, mm-hmm. I think, 7 excerpts from the radio show there. And there's also a list of you know, events that's coming up. Like, I'm going to be down south next week at Capitola and at UC Santa Cruz.
Excellent.
And the one wonderful thing is the book club of Books, Inc. and Alameda is reading the book for October. So,
oh, that's fantastic. Yeah. So we do have to close our show. And we were wondering if we always like to ask our guests mm-hmm. for a piece of advice. So we were wondering if you would give us the honor of imparting your wisdom upon us and our listeners about maybe somebody who has had a traumatic experience as a child and they have their parents still living. What would you suggest to them?
Well, I hope that they would get support, you know, and it could be therapy, it could be reading something, so that they can feel better in themselves. And then I would say with your family, it's often very complicated, but to persist, you know, to keep trying if it feels right to do that. Not everybody has receptive parents. So you have to judge that, whether it's going to be healthy and healing for you to give it a try with your parents. But I know, like I said, with my father, he was very reluctant to talk and he was very resistant. But then when we did, and I persisted, we were able to really come. It astounded me as well. So sometimes you can really be surprised and astounded by, if you really try from your heart to talk not in an attacking way, but really, here's what it was like for me, Mom. Here's what it was like for me, Dad. Are you willing to hear me? can we talk about this? I think it would really help us all if we could talk about this. So if you can kind of approach it from that way, mm-hmm. then mm-hmm. go for it.
Mm-hmm. And briefly about the benefits, I think you can add a little bit more to that, the benefits of if they wanted to do this and why do this, based on your own experience.
You know, I think it just made me feel more comfortable in myself, in the world, and going around. And like something that really hurt didn't hurt as much anymore.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here tonight, Hannah Wilson.
Thank you for interviewing me. It's really delightful and wonderful to be with both of you.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. And like Hannah Wilson, you too can be living proof that if you take a good hard look at your life and you can change your trauma into a real victory and be healed and be whole. Until next month.
Good night.
So many answers, I don't know. There are so many answers. Realize that to question is how we grow. To question is to grow. So I step out of the ordinary. I can feel my soul ascending.
Join us next Sunday night at 8 p.m. for Outbeat Music with Michaela Kennan. And remember, you can always listen and download past shows and find out more about what's coming up on Outbeat Radio on our own website at outbeatradio.com. Yeah, so do it today, yeah, 'cause I can see it there.